appears as if the political upheaval was engineered by rival coalition members who basically failed to execute a power coup.
Exploring the tangled politics of Malaysia. It's Thursday, February 27, and this is VOA Asia. I'm Doug Bernard in Washington. Also ahead, the coronavirus may yet tank the global economy. The latest chapter of the 2020 presidential race. And learning to ski among some of the world's highest peaks. It's all on today's VOA Asia. The World Health Organization now reports that there are about 81,000 confirmed cases of the COVID-19 virus around the globe. But for the first time, the number of new cases outside of China is greater than the new cases in China. At least 78,190 cases have been found in China, with 2,718 deaths. There are now at least 2,790 cases in 37 countries and 44 deaths outside of China, where the disease was first identified. The coronavirus outbreak continues to spread, with infections in 33 countries, the latest being reported in Afghanistan, Bahrain, Iraq, and Oman. Gary Hufbauer is a senior fellow at the Peterson Institute for International Economics. He spoke to VOA's Steve Miller and told him that while stock markets plunging are getting a lot of attention, that's not what he's watching to determine how healthy the global economy really is.
The most specific two things I'm looking for are, one, a reliable test that can detect before a person has developed antibodies whether that person has been is now carrying the coronavirus. We do not have that test now. Secondly, I'm looking for a vaccine that can be administered to people to protect them, as we use vaccines against the flu, to protect them against the coronavirus. We do not have that vaccine now. So I'm not actually looking at economic indicators. I'm looking at health indicators, because the current spotty evidence suggests that a person can be a carrier without showing much symptoms for up to 30 days. And what that means is that we've got carriers going all over the world and exposing people, which has approximately a 2% mortality rate. That is very scary, because what it means in economic terms is that governments, without these two tests, without those, what governments are going to do is all kinds of quarantine measures, which interrupt all supply chains that you can imagine, as we've seen in extreme cases in China and in South Korea.
Now, let me follow up on that really quickly, because, sure, you know, speaking at the WHO on Tuesday, they said one of the, you know, things that China did correctly was institute some of these quarantines and movement restriction policies to try and reduce and limit the spread of disease. Now, if we take a look at the quarantine on the Diamond Princess, which was the vessel that was docked in Yokohama, Japan, and how that spread among the people on board the ship there, and presumably, however, the virus is being spread in the city of Wuhan, which is the epicenter of this. You know, as people continue to travel, as the incubation period appears to be somewhere along a month, you know, you have all this uncertainty. And is that the uncertainty that we're seeing now reflected in the market as the number of cases continues to grow up? And, you know, governments are now saying, hey, we need to, you know, take more money out of our budgets and give it to preventative measures. And as companies are starting to miss some of their key deadlines because of supply chain, you know, restrictions and, you know, reductions in the follow through of goods?
Oh, absolutely. We're seeing all that, because without the tests and the vaccine, which I mentioned, the only thing governments can do is interrupt interactions between people. And that means, you know, halting airlines. It means a lot of precautions before the sailors board a, you know, a container vessel, because, you know, if they get the coronavirus in the middle of the Pacific. That's not good for moving that vessel. Ports where you get a lot of people working together, you're worried about that. So that's all that government can do is interrupt interaction between people. And what is the economy? Well, it's basically interaction between people, but also interactions over the internet. So you do have both. But the interaction between people have been, seriously limited in some countries, and they will be limited in more countries until, a more targeted approach can be devised.
Gary Huffbauer with the Peterson Institute for International Economics, speaking with our Steve Miller. These are among the top Asia headlines you'll find right now on voanews.com. U.S. senators are urging stronger sanctions enforcement amid a prolonged stalemate in denuclearization talks with North Korea. Indian Prime Minister Narendra Modi appealed for calm after days of clashes between Hindus and minority Muslims over a controversial citizenship law. And the coronavirus outbreak will likely take a bigger than expected toll on China's economy this quarter. You can read and watch much more on VOA Asia Facebook and Twitter, plus our website, voanews.com. VOA Asia continues. Malaysia's decades-old political rivals Mahathir Mohamad and Anwar Ibrahim set out claims to lead the Southeast Asian country on Wednesday after Mahathir's shock resignation as prime minister sparked turmoil. Ivan Tu is president, associate professor of law at Georgetown University. I asked her what I thought was a simple question. Why did Mahathir Mohamad resign in the first place?
Well, I mean, there have been a couple of different narratives exploding about that. Initially, I think the narrative when all of these political developments first started was that the domestic political coup looked like a political move by Mahathir to stay in power and not to transition power to Anwar Ibrahim as promised. However, that narrative appeared to shift on Monday after Dr. Mahathir resigned, both as prime minister but also chairman of his political party, Bersatu. And so now the narrative that emerged after that was that it appears as if the political upheaval was engineered by rival coalition members who basically failed to execute a power coup, and Mahathir refused to go along with the new coalition that would have included UMNO as well as PAS, which is the Malaysian Islamic Party, which then led to him resigning both as prime minister and also as chairman of his political party, Bersatu. And
so does all this mean that Mohamad's political career is over for all points and purposes?
For Prime Minister Mahathir Mohamad?
Yes.
No, so I think we're currently in a period where it's hugely uncertain what is going to happen. In fact, if anything, at the point when he did resign and was reappointed as interim prime minister, it looked at that point as if he was in an even more powerful position than he was before that, because at that point, we saw on Monday all the different political coalitions and political parties, in fact, like stating that they wish Mahathir to be at the helm of whichever governing coalition was going to go ahead. That situation has shifted somewhat. I think as this, Mahathir then suggested that he would want to helm what he called a unity government, so a unity government that would that with him as prime minister, and at that point we saw some of the political parties such as Barisan Nasional and PAS withdrawing support for Mahathir as prime minister and calling instead for snap elections, saying that they did not want to work in a coalition with the Democratic Action Party, DAP. And then we then now have seen a situation where there has been a new sort of a shift in confidence of some of the members of parliament from Anwar Ibrahim's party, PKR, and DAP announcing support for Anwar as prime minister instead. So I think we have actually a couple of different blocks going on here. There are, like, there are certain members of parliament who are backing Mahathir still to be prime minister, and then there's another block which is backing Anwar to be prime minister, and then a third block which we're not quite sure what is going on.
With all these machinations, is this something that the political leaders can work out on their own, or do they need, in effect, the permission of the king?
So let me just back up and say what the king's role should be constitutionally here. According to Malaysia's constitution, the king shall appoint as prime minister the person who, in his judgment, is likely to command the confidence of the majority of the lower house of parliament. So that's according to the Malaysian constitution as well as Malaysia's Westminster constitutional conventions. And so what we're seeing here is that the king shall appoint the person who he thinks is most likely to command the confidence of the majority. The huge question then, of course, is who commands the confidence of the majority? And so over the last few days, we've actually seen the king take a fairly central and unprecedented role in trying to determine that. He's called for all of the members of parliament to the palace, and so he has personally interviewed all members of parliament to determine who each of them would have as prime minister, or whether they would prefer for this to be, well, for parliament to be dissolved. But either way, it appears as if the king is personally taking a central role to determine who commands the confidence of the majority. So that's the king's role. And so in the current situation, where it appears that there are at least two leaders who are attempting to command the confidence of the majority, Mahathir and Anwar, I think, like, what we're going to see over the next few days will probably be determined by both political negotiations and trading among the political parties and leaders themselves, as well as potentially if neither of them have the numbers to make a workable majority coalition, then the king may have a role in trying to broker a compromise.
Yvonne Tu, Malaysia specialist and associate professor of law at Georgetown University. Happening now in Asia, coronavirus outbreaks inside two South Korean medical facilities reveal the vulnerability of people with disabilities to the disease that appears poised to become a global pandemic. Stay up to date with VOA. You're listening to VOA Asia. We're happy you're with us on VOA Asia. U.S. Senator Bernie Sanders was the target of his rivals for the Democratic presidential nomination in the latest televised debate, which was held Tuesday in Charleston, South Carolina. Sanders has emerged as the national frontrunner after victories in the first three nominating contests, but his rivals contend that the self-declared Democratic Socialist would lose to Republican President Donald Trump in November's national election. VOA's Richard Green has the latest chapter in the 2020 presidential election.
In the face-to-face confrontation carried live by CBS News, Sanders, an independent from Vermont who aligns with the Democrats in the Senate, was asked how he would convince voters he would make a better steward of the economy than President Trump, despite the recent gains in the stock market.
Last year, real wage increases for the average worker were less than 1%. Half of our people are living paycheck to paycheck. That is not an economy that's working for the American people. That's an economy working for the 1%. We're going to create an economy for all.
Sanders has promised to expand Medicare, the health insurance program for America's elderly citizens, to make it available for everyone, regardless of age. But his rivals, including Minnesota Senator Amy Klobuchar, claim that Sanders' plans to sharply increase social welfare spending for health and education would be too costly.
No, the math does not add up. In fact, just on 60 Minutes this weekend, he said he wasn't going to rattle through the the nickels and the dimes. Well, let me tell you how many nickels and dimes we're talking about. Nearly $60 trillion. Do you know how much that is for all of his programs?
That is
three times the American economy, not the federal government, the entire American economy.
Former Vice President Joe Biden used the shooting rampage at a predominantly black church in Charleston in 2015 to confront Sanders about his previous opposition to legislation that would have held gun manufacturers liable for gun violence in the United States.
Bernie voted five times against the Brady Bill and wanted a waiting period. No, let me finish. And waited. A waiting period of 12 hours. I'm not saying he's responsible for the nine deaths, but that man would not have been able to get that weapon with the waiting period had been what I suggest until you are cleared.
Sanders' opponents have also said his decades-old favorable assessments of such leftist dictators as the late Fidel Castro of Cuba would be rejected by moderate and conservative voters in certain parts of the country. Former New York Mayor Michael Bloomberg even suggested Sanders was being used by Russian President Vladimir Putin.
I think that Donald Trump thinks it would be better if he's president. I do not think so. Vladimir Putin thinks that Donald Trump should be president of the United States, and that's why Russia is helping you get elected, so you'll lose to him.
The debate comes just 4 days before South Carolina, with its 54 national delegates in play, holds its primary. Biden, who was once the Democratic frontrunner, holds a narrow lead over Sanders in South Carolina, but observers say there is a possibility Sanders could also win that state, putting him in a commanding position ahead of so-called Super Tuesday voting 3 days later, when a massive haul of more than 1,300 delegates is at stake. Richard Green, VOA News, Washington.
VOA Asia Facebook is the choice of millions to see and read the latest stories about Asia and the United States. Follow us on VOA Asia Facebook and say hello online or on your smartphone. Subscribe to all of our platforms for free. See, hear, and read and share all of the latest from VOA Asia anytime. VOA Asia is your trusted source for news and great features.
This news alert from VOA Asia. Iran's growing coronavirus outbreak has triggered more angst in the country, preventing thousands of visiting Pakistanis from returning home and fueling fears of contagion in prison. At least 5,000 Pakistanis have been stuck in Iran since the border was closed. This is VOA Asia. This news break now from VOA Asia. A bombing in the Afghan capital Kabul Wednesday injured at least 9 civilians, the first significant incidents of violence during the week-long reduced fighting period agreed to between U.S.-backed Afghan security forces and the Taliban insurgents. You're listening to VOA Asia. Now on VOA Asia, fears of coronavirus transmission have waylaid two cruise ships and sent stocks plummeting for cruise lines. VOA correspondent Mariama Diallo reports on the effects that the outbreak is likely to have on the travel industry now and the foreseeable future.
The seemingly inexorable spread of the coronavirus is taking a toll on cruise operators and airlines as people rethink travel plans. Dr. Ross Klein spoke to VOA via Skype.
Kind of gave the industry a black eye with the number of canceled sailings because of Asia no longer being accessible. And then the number of passengers that may be canceling or that are not booking because of the fear of getting ill. And that'll have it could have a long-term effect.
Cruise companies' stocks have fallen sharply, some by as much as one-third in recent weeks.
Well, the stocks that have been hardest hit by the coronavirus have been those related to the travel industry. Cruise industry really front and center.
Royal Caribbean Cruises and Carnival Cruise Line say cancellations will drag down their earnings this year.
When the virus first appeared, Carnival Corporation said, and this was about around the 12th or 13th of February, that the virus was going to have an impact of 65 cents per share. Now, since then, I think the virus had a much greater dent on the company's operations in terms of cancellations and other issues. So my sense is the cost just in terms of dealing with the virus is going to be fairly significant.
Since February 4th, when Carnival's Diamond Princess cruise ship was forced to dock in Japan, more than 650 passengers have tested positive for coronavirus, and four people have died from the disease. Other cruise liners have also been affected, including the MS Westerdam, which was stuck at sea as five ports refused to allow the vessel to dock.
Considering what has happened with the Diamond Princess, I guess it makes sense for cruise lines to be wary about traveling to that part of the world.
Despite all the concerns, the World Health Organization says it still considers cruise ship travel a manageable risk. And Zane Kirby, CEO of American Society of Travel Advisors, says outside of China, it's not all doom and gloom.
We're really happy to report that outside of Asia, and Asia for the cruise market is very, very small for travel advisors within the United States. But the cruise market to the Caribbean, Mediterranean, are all doing very, very well. In fact, we had the best January we've ever had.
Kirby also says the cruise industry is resilient, having dealt with previous crises, including the norovirus, SARS, MERS, Zika, and the 2019 global recession. Mariama Diallo, VOA News.
This is Science in a Minute.
It's been a little over 15 months since NASA's InSight lander touched down on Mars. The space agency reports that six new published papers detail some of the findings made by InSight, both above and deep below the red planet's surface. Scientists found that Mars trembles much more than expected, with 174 seismic events, or Mars quakes, over a period of 235 Martian days, or 241 and a half Earth days. Mars doesn't have the same tectonic activity that causes quakes here on Earth, so scientists suggest volcanic activity are causing the Mars quakes. While the red planet lost its magnetic field billions of years ago, InSight provided information that when it did exist, it magnetized rocks located between 61 meters and several kilometers underground. The scientists are still waiting for data from InSight that can determine whether Mars has a solid or liquid core. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
Malam Jaba in northern Pakistan's Swat Valley is home to one of two main ski resorts in Pakistan. It's also home to Pakistan's famous ski school, where these days lessons are free. VOA's Umar Farooq has more in this report, narrated by Bejan Hamdard.
The picturesque mountains of Swat Valley are covered with snow for most of the year, and that makes it a destination for recreational skiers as well as professional athletes. But the Samson's Resort Malam Jaba in the valley is trying to attract local kids to a free ski school in the hopes of grooming the next generation of skiers.
It's good because we get equipment and everything for free.
There is a lot of snow in our village, and now that we are skiing on them, it is a lot of fun.
The program is called Snow Ski School, and it currently has 40 students, including girls.
There are a total of three places to learn skiing in Pakistan: Malam Jaba, Rutu Snow School, and Air Force Snow School.
Trainer Muhammad Sharif says that it is not very difficult teaching the kids how to ski, since they are very familiar with how to navigate on snow.
Kids here have a lot of talent. They learn quickly, and the more they see it, the quicker they learn. Just with little training, they improve.
Malam Jaba Resort is also a popular destination among city residents who come here to unwind and get away from their city's noise and their busy lives. Locals here hope that Malam Jaba becomes a site for international ski competitions in the near future, which could be a big boost to the local economy. For Omar Farooq in Peshawar, Pakistan, Bejan Hamdard, VOA News.
And that's VOA Asia for today and this week. We'll be back again with you next week. We hope you will join us then as well. And until then, be well.